Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says the Iraqi government is requesting U.S. airstrikes against Sunni militants. What do attacks on Iraq's oil fields mean for China? Bergdahl's disappearance is probed on Capitol Hill. Greenpeace backs a new Obama marine initiative.
It's great news for the oceans, for sure. You know, we live on the water planet, and it's easy to forget sometimes just how interconnected everything is.
And we'll visit a Brazil football museum attracting passionate fans. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The top U.S. military official says the Iraqi government has requested U.S. airstrikes to aid the fight against Sunni militants, known as the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, who have taken over key cities of northern Iraq. Army General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, spoke about the situation in Iraq before a Senate subcommittee Wednesday.
Al-Qaeda-inspired extremists raising flags over Iraq's embattled cities triggers in me the same thing that runs through the minds of any veteran who served there, which is bitter disappointment that Iraq's leaders failed to unite for the good of their people.
U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said the blame for the insurgency lies not just with the militants, but also with the Iraqi government for failing to establish a working relationship among different groups in the country's leadership.
I think we go back to who is responsible for this. ISIL, they invaded, but also this current government in Iraq has never fulfilled the commitments it made to bring a unity government together with the Sunnis, the Kurds, and the Shia. We have worked hard with them within the confines of our ability to help them do that, but we can't dictate to them.
The United States has ruled out sending combat troops back to Iraq, but President Obama has ordered 275 military personnel to help provide security for the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. NBC Television's Savannah Guthrie asked U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry about the possibility of U.S. airstrikes in Iraq.
Nothing is off the table. All options are still available to the president.
Seems like the U.S. was totally caught off guard by this.
Well, I don't think. Look, our people on the ground in Iraq have seen the increased intensity. We've been watching this happening. We have been engaged in efforts over the months. We've been beefing up our assistance, our presence.
But did you act too slowly? I mean, Maliki was asking for help with airstrikes in the last few weeks. As this was coming, as the ISIS was coming toward this part of Iraq, why didn't we act then?
For a lot of different reasons, not the least of which is we didn't have operational theater capacity at that point in time, partly because Prime Minister Maliki denied the kind of permissions necessary.
That raises the question, why come to Maliki's rescue now? I mean, isn't he a
this
big
is not
part
about
of the
Maliki.
Problem?
Let me stress. What the United States is doing is about Iraq. It is not about Maliki. And nothing that the president decides to do is going to be focused specifically on Prime Minister Maliki. It is focused on the people of Iraq.
But it may
Shia,
benefit Maliki.
Sunni, Kurd. Well, that's up to the people of Iraq to decide. But the United States is deeply concerned about the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, ISIL as we know it, that has moved in. They represent a threat to every country in the region. They're more extreme even than Al-Qaeda, and they are threatening the United States and Western interests.
You've mentioned that the U.S. is open, at least, to possibly working with Iran as you deal with this situation with ISIS in northern Iraq.
First of all, I don't know where this comes from, that we've suggested working with Iran in that regard. We have heard.
I thought you said it in an interview the other day.
What I said is we are interested in communicating with Iran to make clear that the Iranians know what we're thinking and we know what they're thinking, and that there's a sharing of information so people aren't making mistakes.
So just to be clear, the U.S. isn't considering working hand in hand with Iran, because I think for a lot of Americans,
let me be absolutely
that's a head scratcher.
No, that's not. It would be a head scratcher, and no, we're not sitting around contemplating how we're going to do that or if we're going to do that. That's not on the table.
Dick Cheney wrote today, rarely has a U.S. president been so wrong about so much at the expense of so many.
This is the man who took us into Iraq saying this. Please.
What's happening now in Iraq is directly related to the situation in Syria. Did the U.S., did the president miss the moment, make a huge mistake by not trying to turn the tide in Syria then. And what's happening in Iraq now is just the chickens coming home to roost.
Well, Savannah, let me just say this. There's plenty of time going down the road here for people to have postmortems and to make decisions. We are the largest single donor of humanitarian assistance. We are deeply engaged in working with our allies and friends in the region. We are assisting, training, doing work in terms of providing non-lethal aid and assistance.
But doesn't the evidence suggest it's not working? Because instead of things getting better because of our assistance, in fact, a group like ISIS is on the rise and now taking more territory.
ISIS is on the rise because Assad is a magnet for terrorists of all ilk and walks who are come there to try to unseat him.
Didn't you advocate for arming the moderate opposition when you were a senator? I mean, didn't you think that was the right thing to do?
I did.
And doesn't it kill you now to see what's happened?
I know where you're trying to look. Let me just make it clear. We are augmenting our assistance in significant ways.
What do you say to Iraq veterans, those who've lost so much, or families of those who lost everything in Iraq, who are looking now and saying, what was that for? No sooner have we left than everything goes back to just the way it was.
That remains to be seen. And the test is in really these next few days and weeks. And we are going to do everything in our power to follow through and try to get the job done through diplomacy, if we can, in order to honor their sacrifice.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry speaking on NBC Television's Today Show. Soner Çaptay is the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. VOA's Carol Castiel asked him about the situation in Iraq and its relationship with Turkey.
We note that the United States is pressing Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki for a more inclusive government, greater power-sharing arrangement with the Sunni communities, which are increasingly sort of turning toward ISIS because they feel that the government is not really protecting them. What does Turkey want, and is Turkey in agreement with this approach? What are your thoughts with regard to what the government wants?
In fact, Turkey broke ranks with the Maliki government in Baghdad long before the United States took a negative or a less benign view of him. Around the time of the last Iraqi elections in 2010, when Maliki won, Turkey actually supported his opponent, Alavi, and his more secular and inclusive bloc. And that bloc did not end up forming the government. And so when Maliki formed the government, first of all, he was upset that Turkey had supported his opposition. And I think Turkish-Iraqi ties started to unravel soon as after Maliki got empowered as Iraq's new prime minister. That relationship was in a downhill trajectory. And I think it was aided by the fact that at that time, Turkey had already started a policy of rapprochement with Iraqi Kurds, who had pivoted to Turkey earlier on to sell their oil as an outlet to the outside world for security. And also in alignment with Turkey's, I think, view of secular politics as opposed to more radical elements coming from the south. I think the Iraqi government saw Turkey's meddling in the affairs of the Kurds in the north as meddling in its own sovereignty and took issue with that. So Turkish-Iraqi relations were already on a downhill trajectory. But I think what has happened in the last year, the exclusion of the Sunni Arabs from the central government has basically made the Iraqi government look like a Shiite force only in the northern part of that country. And I think that has added to the alienation of the Sunni Arab population, which is one reason why probably ISIS has been able to gain some grassroots support. It's not to say that it dominates the region by the will of the people. I think it's still dominated by the will of its sword and its violence. But it definitely has gained some traction in the north. And I think Turkish-Iraqi relations, meaning Turkey's relation with the central government of Iraq, will not be repaired for a long time, given that the Kurds are now in the north increasingly trying to eject themselves out of Iraq, both financially and politically. And Turkey just seems to be happy with that. I think what we're seeing is...
Turkey is what?
Happy with this. What we're seeing is a further strengthening of Turkish-Iraqi-Kurdish ties to the detriment of Turkish ties with the central government in Baghdad.
Okay, one more quick follow-up, and that is some analysts have accused Turkey of providing or allowing groups like ISIS to cross the border from Turkey into Syria and from there into Iraq. Is there any basis for that?
I can't say that Turkey allowed ISIS to cross, but what I can say is that Turkey allowed other groups, including some radicals, to cross into Syria from the very early stages of that uprising in that country. Turkey's calculus in Syria when the uprising or the pro-democracy movement in that country started was the following. Assad will fall and good guys will take over. So if Assad is going to fall and good guys will take over, it doesn't hurt to let the bad guys to go in and fight Assad, because when the good guys take over, they can clean up the bad guys. Well, Assad is not falling and good guys are not taken over. So Turkey's strategy is a misconceived one, an ill-executed one, in the sense that Turkey is now realizing allowing anyone to go into Syria to fight Assad is not a good idea, because these guys will stay there and they're going to form a long-term threat to Turkey. And now, I think in the last year, there has already been military confrontation between Turkish government and radical elements in Syria, including groups belonging to ISIS. So Turkey is already unfriendly with ISIS on many terms. And what is really interesting is...
Unfriendly.
Not just in Iraq, but also in Syria, the Kurds are appearing as a cordon sanitaire that protects Turkey from instability and radical al-Qaeda-related elements. Turkey has a very long border with Syria. That's 540 miles. A very large part of that border is actually protected by Kurdish enclaves, which are buffering between Turkey and ISIS to the south.
We plan on bringing you more of their conversation Friday, but you can hear all of their conversation this weekend on Press Conference USA here on The Voice of America. China is the number one buyer of Iraqi oil. Last year, the China National Petroleum Corporation, or CNPC, produced 299 million barrels from Iraq, almost a third of its overseas output. The sectarian battle that is now tearing through Iraq moved to that country's largest oil field on Tuesday. The Beji refinery provides fuel for domestic consumption in Iraq, and reports say any lengthy outage there risks long lines at the gas pump and electricity shortages. But if other oil fields are attacked, what would that mean for China? VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Holly Morrow, a fellow of the Geopolitics of Energy at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, about the situation as it affects China.
China currently buys about half of Iraq's oil output, so they're important to each other. China is very important to Iraq as a consumer of its oil, and Iraq is important to China as a, I think it's its fifth largest, somewhere around there, fourth or fifth largest supplier of oil. So it's a big deal. But the thing that always needs to be kept in mind when talking about particularly oil flows around the world is that oil is a fungible commodity. So even if all of Iraq's production went offline, say, China could buy the oil that it needs from other places. It's not restricted to, you know, certain allotments of oil from countries A, B, and C. Now, the way that the Iraq crisis would likely translate into an impact on China's interests is, I think, two ways. One is the impact on price, and we've already seen that the Iraq crisis is having an impact on the price of oil globally, which, as the largest importer of oil, affects China, along with the U.S. and others, but principally China. And then also the impact on any Chinese workers in Iraq. And I have heard that China, CNPC in this case, is evacuating workers out of Iraq. But all of that is to say China is important as both a producer through CNPC of Iraq's oil and as a consumer of Iraq's oil, but it is not, it's not going to threaten fundamentally China's security of supply if some of this oil goes offline. And the thing that should be kept in mind is that most of Iraq's oil production, and particularly the projects that Chinese companies are involved in, are in the Shiite South, so much less vulnerable to ISIS-controlled and some of the other Sunni-dominated parts of Iraq.
Well, even taking that into consideration, do you think there is any talk in China among the Chinese or among the Chinese and other countries about China possibly becoming a political player in Iraq?
I don't think so. And I think the reason why is because China is generally not looking to involve itself in complicated disputes far away from home, especially in a situation like Iraq, where the U.S. role and influence is as large as it is in Iraq. You know, I think in Iraq, unlike in some other places like Sudan, China can essentially free ride, if you will, on the U.S. role. So the U.S., I think, is likely to have to become involved in some way to defuse this crisis, roll back ISIS, if they can. And China will be the beneficiary of any intervention from the U.S., so it doesn't have to put its own blood and treasure at risk.
You said that China could just find other suppliers of oil. Where do they go?
Global markets. The way global oil markets function is that any buyer can basically buy a barrel of oil at any given time at the prevailing global price, because there's no supply shortage right now. So when crises happen in Iraq or Libya or any of the big oil suppliers, it never means that people cannot buy the oil they need. It just usually means that the price of oil goes higher.
Holly Morrow, a fellow of the Geopolitics of Energy at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
The service record of a U.S. Army sergeant freed by the Taliban has come under congressional scrutiny. Many Republican lawmakers and some Democrats continue to object to the prisoner exchange that freed five Taliban militants. As VOA's Michael Bowman reports, a House panel heard emotionally charged testimony about Sergeant Bo Bergdahl's alleged desertion of his unit in Afghanistan, as well as a life reportedly lost searching for him.
One day after Bergdahl's release from 5 years of captivity, President Barack Obama's national security advisor, Susan Rice, went on U.S. television proclaiming that the sergeant had served, quote, with honor and distinction. A fellow soldier in Bergdahl's unit, retired specialist Cody Full, took issue with Rice, saying the sergeant intentionally left his post and appeared to have actually sought out the Taliban.
The only thing you can count on as combat is the commitment of your fellow American. Knowing that someone you needed to trust deserted you in war and did so on his own free will is the ultimate betrayal.
Full's firsthand account has yet to be independently verified. The committee also heard from Andy Andrews, the father of a U.S. officer, Darren Andrews, who was killed in a clash with militants, reportedly while searching for Bergdahl.
Bergdahl walked away and was not captured, and that Darren was killed while searching for him.
President Obama has said that all U.S. service members deserve to be rescued, regardless of the circumstances of their capture. During the hearing, no House members said Bergdahl was unworthy of freedom from the Taliban. But Republican Ileana Ruslatinen said she would not have made the prisoner exchange that Mr. Obama first mentioned as a possibility to lawmakers in 2011.
I opposed the swap not because I did not want to bring Bo home. It's important to have him home. I opposed the swap because a proposal would have resulted in a huge coup for the Taliban, would have benefited them, jeopardized the safety and security of our brave men and women in uniform, and compromised our national security interests.
Those comments provoked a vigorous response from Democratic Congressman Ted Deutch, who accused Republicans of hypocrisy.
We can have a debate over whether the price for Sergeant Bergdahl was too high, but we should also be reminded of the 532 Guantanamo Bay detainees who were transferred before this president came to office. Where was the outrage then?
Deutch also criticized what he sees as a rush to judge Sergeant Bergdahl's service record before an exhaustive review promised by the Pentagon is conducted. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
As we've been reporting, U.S. President Barack Obama is planning to create the world's largest marine preserve, significantly expanding a remote region of the Pacific Ocean where drilling, fishing, and other commercial activities are prohibited. The waters are adjacent to seven islands and atolls controlled by the U.S. For reaction to the announcement, we spoke with John Hocevar, Oceans Campaign Director for Greenpeace.
It's great news for the oceans, for sure. You know, we live on the water planet, and it's easy to forget sometimes just how interconnected everything is and how much we depend on a healthy ocean. So this is a great step. We have this wonderful network of national parks on land, but in the ocean, there's very few protected areas where fishing or other extractive industry is banned.
What needs to be done to help protect our oceans?
First, we need a network of protected areas exactly like this. Certainly in remote areas like this, but also in areas where fishing is currently taking place. For example, in Alaska, where half of the seafood caught in the United States is harvested, there are no fully protected areas. And it's not saying that we need to ban fishing. We just need some areas where we set aside so that fish populations and other marine life can recover.
Even though this area is protected, that doesn't mean it's protected from plastics and other things that are out there in the ocean. How bad is that problem?
It is a serious problem. The good news is that we've come a very long way in reducing most types of pollution that have been entering the ocean. We have bans on dumping of most types of waste, but still there is a lot of plastic that's still entering the ocean. And that is something that each of us can do something about.
What about the plastic that's already out there? I've seen pictures of these islands, virtual islands made out of plastic junk.
There's an awful lot of plastic out there, and unfortunately, the only thing we can really do is to make sure that it doesn't enter the ocean in the first place. And that's partly, you know, the classic reduce, reuse, recycle. I think it's been great to see more and more cities and even some larger areas start to ban plastic bags, for example. And those are the kinds of things that we need to continue.
Would you like to add anything else?
It's been great to see President Obama announce his intention to establish this much expanded protected area in the far Pacific. We would love to see the U.S. step up and support conservation in the high seas areas outside the U.S. And, for example, there is a discussion happening now about the need for a new United Nations biodiversity agreement. And it has very widespread support internationally. And so if the U.S. Starts to support that as well, it may just tip the balance.
John Ossevarm, Oceans Campaign Director for Greenpeace.
Put your flags up in the sky. Put them in the sky.
Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet, and we'll bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com.
In the heart of Sao Paulo, Brazil, there is an interactive attraction like no other. It's the city's football museum. For lovers of the World Cup, world history, and Brazilian culture, this is one of the country's prime destinations. VOA's Ramon Taylor takes us there.
Over 100 years of football history in one of the most emblematic stadiums in the world. After visiting this museum, you'll understand why Brazilians live and breathe this sport.
As you enter the stadium, Brazilian football legend and three-time World Cup champion Pelé welcomes you personally in three languages. In fact, he greets about 1,000 visitors per day on average, 2,000 per day during the World Cup. The sight is a treat for more than just the eyes. You'll hear the sounds of goals and whistles and experience the taste of victory and defeat. Daniela Alfonsi is the museum's content director.
We have 15 rooms in long-term exhibition that works with the motion, that work with experiences. So in each room, you can feel the voice of the bleachers, of the supporters on the bleachers. You can hear the radio narrations. You can see the football as art more than as a sport.
Pelé once called football o jogo bonito, or the beautiful game. A nickname that has stuck ever since. In this museum, it is easy to see why. Carlos Acosta is a Colombian who lives in Sao Paulo. He sees Brazilians' passion for football as an inspiration to the world.
It's contagious. The Brazilians breathe football all the time. They eat football. They drink football all day.
There is one room in particular that tugs at every Brazilian's heart, a theater that mourns Brazil's historic 2-1 defeat by Uruguay in the 1950 World Cup final in front of more than 90,000 fans at the Maracanã Stadium in Rio de Janeiro. Luckily, the sadness is short-lived. With a record 5 World Cup titles, Brazilians have a lot to be proud of, as displayed in the interactive Hall of Heroes. And in case that's still not enough to entertain your senses, there are games designed to bring out the competitor in everyone, not to mention an opportunity to become the newest hero of the 2014 World Cup. Reporting from Sao Paulo, Brazil, I'm Ramon Taylor for VOA News.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On this day in 1623, French philosopher, mathematician, and physicist Blaise Pascal was born. Among his achievements was a theory of projective geometry known as Pascal's theorem. He invented the first mechanical calculator and helped formulate the theory of probability that has influenced the disciplines of economics and social science. On this day in 1862, the U.S. Congress abolished slavery in the U.S. territories. In 1864, during the American Civil War, the Confederate ship Alabama engaged a Union warship, Kearsarge, off the French coast. After a one-hour battle, the Alabama was sunk, putting an end to 2 years of costly attacks on Union shipping. In 1867, Austrian Archduke Ferdinand Maximilian, installed as Emperor of Mexico by French Emperor Napoleon III, was executed on the orders of Mexican President Benito Juarez after French forces withdrew. In 1910, the first Father's Day was observed in Spokane, Washington. Inspired by a church service honoring mothers, a woman whose widowed father had raised her and five siblings convinced church leaders to celebrate fathers. Today, Father's Day is a national day of celebration in the U.S., observed on the third Sunday of June. On this day in 1917, Britain's King George V ordered the British royal family to change its name from the Germanic Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor. The king made the decision in the midst of World War I when his country was fighting Germany. On June 19, 1953, convicted communist spies Ethel and Julius Rosenberg were executed for passing nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
On the night of September 11th, 2012, members of the Ansar al-Sharia terrorist group attacked two U.S. government facilities in Benghazi, Libya. Using machine guns, rocket-propelled grenades, and mortars, the militants targeted the U.S. Special Mission compound and a nearby annex in repeated assaults, killing four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador, wounding two more U.S. personnel, and three Libyan contract guards. Both facilities were destroyed. Rewards were offered, and an intensive search mounted for those responsible for the attack. On June 15th, U.S. military personnel arrested a key suspect in the operation, Ahmed Abu Katala, a senior leader of Ansar al-Sharia in Benghazi, has been charged with murder and other charges and will be sent to the United States to stand trial. Others involved in the attack remain at large, and the United States will do whatever it takes to see that justice is done. Created after the fall of Libya's longtime ruler, Muammar Gaddafi, Ansar al-Sharia has been involved in many attacks in the region, targeting civilians and assassinating or attempting to assassinate security officials and political actors in eastern Libya. Its members continue to pose a threat to U.S. interests in Libya and have been designated as international terrorist organizations. Toward this end, the Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $10 million for information leading to the arrest or conviction of any individual responsible for the Benghazi attacks. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these individuals, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy or the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.